Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Indie Business Podcast. I'm your host, Donna Maria, and you have arrived at the one place where we empower you to enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way. Well, here at Indie, you know, we focus a lot on helping you sell your products to consumers. And that's because so many of our listeners are artisans and craftspersons who are also business people who sell the products they make. We've discussed in hundreds of shows how important it is to use social media to connect with your target customers. Well, today we are going to discuss a little bit of a different angle for using social media, connecting with your business customers. For many of you, this means connecting with the wholesalers and retailers who want to purchase your products at wholesale prices so they can sell them to their retail customers. And to help us tackle this topic, we have today Paul Gillen and Eric Schwartzman, authors of the new book, Social Marketing to the Business Customer. Let me tell you a little bit about them. Paul Gillen is a tech journalist and speaker who has written hundreds of articles and logged more than 200 radio and TV appearances. Previously, he was editor-in-chief and executive director of Computer World, the technology weekly, and the founding editor of online publisher TechTarget. Eric Schwartzman has advised several major U.S. companies and the federal government on social media strategy. He is the creator of Social Media Bootcamp, the host of the award-winning podcast On the Record Online, and founder of iPressroom. Welcome to the show, Paul and Eric.
Thanks. This is Paul, Donna Maria. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. I'm so glad to have you. And, you know, looking at the subtitle of your book, let's start with that. It says, listen to your B2B market, generate major account leads, and build client relationships. That, in a nutshell, it's a lot is being said there. Give us the high-level overview of what you mean by that B2B market in this subtitle.
Well, B2B is a market in which businesses do business with other businesses. So this can range from companies that we see every day. I mean, Staples is essentially a B2B company. Most of its customers are other business people. Dell is 80% a B2B company. So some very common brands sell primarily to other businesses. And then there are brands that many of us have never heard of, or brands like Conagra, for example, which is a, I believe, an $8 billion company that sells entirely to other food manufacturers. So it's a very large part of the economy and can run the gamut from people providing specialized services like copying and printing, all the way up to Boeing, you know, which makes aircraft that, of course, are sold to other businesses.
And Paul, your book is such an amazing resource, and it's got so much, it's packed with information, but I want our listeners to know that even though there's a lot of detail in here, it really is a really good read, and there's lots of really great stories in here about how companies are using social platforms, and we're so excited about that because we learn, especially as small business owners, Paul, as you know, by really sort of hearing and appropriating the stories of other people. But you say that the rules of B2B marketing have changed over the past few years. Tell us what ways they have changed that mostly affect small business owners.
Well, a lot of people don't understand, I think, how different B2B marketing is. And the impetus for this book actually was Eric and I both attend a lot of seminars, where social media seminars, and we've heard about, you know, great examples of companies selling blue jeans and deodorant and a soda pop through social channels, and these are all great stories. But for many B2B companies, those tactics really don't work very well. And so, you know, we were thinking that what are the differences between B2B and B2C transactions? And one of the big ones is value. That almost every transaction that a B2B companies make with each other involves an exchange of value, and then that's really a critical decision point in a B2B decision: is how is this going to help the business? Also, B2B companies tend to make bet the business type of decisions, where a significant part of the success of the company may depend upon the choice of, for example, an email service provider or somebody who leases trucks for a delivery fleet, or somebody who is or company that provides business software services that help the financials run. So these are often very important decisions. They involve a lot of people. There's a lot of expertise involved. A great deal of information changes hands. And while that sometimes happens in consumer decisions as well, the fact is that most business-to-consumer decisions are made on, they're more impulsive, there's less information exchange involved, and they may be made on factors like what looks nice, what makes me feel good, what is something that I just want to own right now. That really isn't the way that B2B decisions are made.
And one of the things your book points out so eloquently is really that it's all about relationships.
And more so, I think, in B2B than in B2C. To give an example, all of us, or certainly most of your listeners, probably drink a soda of some kind, have preferred beverages, but you don't know the people who make Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola. You don't have any reason to know those people. You just like the products they produce. When you're a business-to-business company and you are making decisions about, for example, who is providing your delivery service or who is providing the maintaining the building, quality of the building in which you work, you want to know that person. Those people are very important to you. The contractors who are working on specific projects with you, you need to know who those people are because you're putting a great deal of faith in them. So B2B relationships usually involve a very high interpersonal component because the importance of what these contractors and business partners do is so critical to each other's success.
And Paul,
I'm sorry, Donna Marie, I don't mean to step on you, but this is one reason to get back to your original question, why relationships are so important. Within a B2C context, relationships are very important, but very often that's between consumers. So consumers consult each other for advice. In B2B relationships, it's much more likely that the relationship is between the buyer and the seller, because there needs to be a trust level there in order for that relationship to really work.
And I love that you're mentioning these distinctions because, and I know for very small business owners who are our listeners, they're kind of used to dealing on the relationship level, mainly on Facebook, because their consumer customers come to them on Facebook. And one thing what you said just makes me think about is the fact that if you have a nice welcoming Facebook page for you and your brand, then it makes it easy for your customers to do what you just said, right, and communicate with each other and meet each other and say how much they love the products that they buy from you, which overall encourages them to buy from each other.
And I can't overemphasize the importance of trust. For the last 200 or 300 years, marketing has basically been done between institutions, and people don't have relationships with institutions. I don't have a strong relationship with the Levi's company. I may like their jeans, but there are I don't know anybody at the Levi's company. We like relationships with other people, though, and one of the reasons that Facebook has been the incredible phenomenon it has been is it enables us to create interactions, to personalize interactions. Twitter is another tool that's very successful for this. And what we find is that when we do business with people whom we know as people, the nature of that relationship changes. And it actually becomes a much more constructive and mutually helpful relationship. It turns out people are much more civil when they deal with other human beings than when they deal with corporate entities. And that's a good thing.
Yes, I would say so. And so as a small business owner who may be, for example, Paul, growing their business from selling their products to consumers and then trying to move into the wholesale arena where you're going to deal more with business customers, some of these relationship components are transferable and you can use some of the same skills building these B2B relationships.
You absolutely can, and we have some wonderful stories in the book. I appreciate your mentioning, Donna Maria, the number of stories we have there, because it is all about storytelling. I like the story of a company called Infusionsoft that is an email services provider and does, I think, a wonderful job of of exposing the people within the company to its customers. So it will take its remarkable employees and it will spotlight them and enables them to speak on behalf of the company. It'll even do stunts. In fact, they had one stunt where they took the VP of marketing and they actually locked him in a room for 24 hours and they had him work. They had him do nothing but communicate on social media for 24 hours. And they had a webcam on him. And they documented the whole thing live on the web. And this is a very humanizing, I love it. It's a very humanizing experience. And it's something that you want to do business with a company where you feel that there are people that you like behind that experience.
Yeah, you know, and let's go with that idea because a company like Infusionsoft, which is, I don't think it's a very huge, massive company, but it's not teeny tiny small, right? What you just described, 24 hours with an employee using social media, which is so connected to their business, it practically costs you nothing. You pay the employee's salary for that, and you know there's not a lot of cost involved. So, Paul, for a small business owner who is making the products that they sell, would you say that something like that would be such an amazing thing to do, set up your camera, tell everybody you're going to be there for 3 hours making your jewelry or making the products, you know, making the purses that you sell or whatever? People would love that, wouldn't they?
Well, I'm a huge fan of small businesses, and social media is what I call the unnatural advantage that small businesses have. And that is because small business owners are very often passionate about what they do, and they're experts at what they do. And they want to share their expertise to show it off, whether they're sign makers or whether they make clothing or jewelry or they're printers or they do fine machine shop work. They want to show that off. And the expertise, social media has given them an unprecedented means to show off their expertise. And that expertise is what builds trust. And understand that for big companies, it's very difficult to do that. Corporations are laden with all kinds of approval cycles and policies and official spokesmen, and there are all kinds of things that big companies will tell you can't do. There's very little that small business people can't do. So I look at one of the earliest successes and ongoing successes of this is a tailor in London called that has a Thomas Mahon, who has a blog called English Cut, and he started over 5 years ago. He started using video and cameras and descriptions to explain to people why a $2,000 suit is actually worth $2,000. Mm-hmm. And he makes very fine finely tailored suits. And he now gets half of his business from overseas. He travels overseas twice a year to take orders from other customers who never would have heard about him otherwise. We see this all the time. I was working with a flooring company at one point. They did industrial flooring. And so we went out and looked at how many flooring contractors are out there on YouTube demonstrating their expertise at putting down different kinds of wood and wood refinishing and industrial flooring. We found dozens of YouTube channels of flooring contractors sharing their expertise. And this is, again, why I call it an unnatural advantage. You don't see big corporations doing that, but for small businesses, it's just so easy to show people how good you are at what you do.
And I love that because I tell my clients a lot who are very small businesses that, you know, the best part about it is that you don't even have to make it up because it's what you do. It's not, you know, some people, depending on your business, you have to write some copy and you have to do. But if you manufacture, as you said, suits or jewelry or whatever it is, really get some decent lighting, turn on the camera, and just do what you do.
I guess you want to give you one more great example I've always loved, and that's a company called Butler Sheet Metal out of the UK, and they make amazing things out of sheet metal, and it really is remarkable what you can make out of sheet metal. And they've been doing this for many years, but they've got employees who have worked there for 30, 35 years. They began taking videos and cameras into the shop and began showcasing the artistry of sheet metal, the amazing things that people were producing, furniture and really artwork with these tools, and using the blog as a way to show this off. Well, now they doubled their business in a year, and almost all of that incremental business came from overseas. Because again, and here's another point, Donna Maria, I want to emphasize, the internet is an international medium. And when you're a small business owner, you can't afford to advertise internationally. But with the internet, you get international for free. Mm-hmm. It comes with the territory. So very often you'll find that the growth in your business will come from territories that you never would have been able to reach a few years ago.
That's a great point. One of the things your book talks about that I think is so great, I want to cover these if we could here in a high-level overview and let people get the book to get the real details to apply them to their businesses. But you say there are 7 ways to use social media. I know there's more than that, but highlight 7 specific ways that B2B, we can use social media to connect with our business customers. Can we just go through those and give people some ideas about how to use them, starting with the first one, which is market intelligence?
Market intelligence, which is really the simplest one, and that's simply a matter of listening. Of course, there are so many tools out there now, ranging from simple searches to RSS feeds to tag clouds, to different kinds of filtering mechanisms that monitor Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook and such, that will tell you what people are talking about. And you can identify not only what people are saying about you and about your competitors, but also if there are emerging opportunities. So if you suddenly see that people are asking for, I need multifunction printers that can also play, music from my iPod, to use a ridiculous example, those kinds of opportunities may emerge first in what people are saying online. The second one is identifying opportunities, and that is what
Can I ask one question about market intelligence? When you talk about there being a lot of different ways to monitor, for small business owners, would you say that Google Reader is one of the most efficient and cost-effective ones that you can use to push that kind of information to yourself?
I think it really is, and a lot of people say that RSS feeds, which is the geeky term for what Google Reader does, are over the hill and are diminishing importance. But I don't think that's true at all. When you find websites that have valuable content that's relevant to your market, very often you can subscribe to those websites, and you can get all of their updates, all of their new information can appear in headline form in your Google Reader. So, Google Reader is my newspaper today. The first thing I do every day is look at my Google Reader, and I get all my headlines there of everything that's new and the topics that interest me.
And
so that's one very simple. And by the way, any Twitter search can also be encoded as an RSS feed and can be plugged into your Google Reader, so you can monitor Twitter keywords that way as well.
That's such a good point. I don't think enough small business owners use Google Reader. There is a blog post at my blog at indiebusinessblog.com. You can use the search tool to find a blog post about how to use Google Reader. It's such an effective tool, right, Paul, because it pushes the information to you. You don't have to go out looking for it. It's such an effective thing. And, again, you called that listening. That is, you plug in the data that you want to receive, that you want to put your ear to the ground to get pushed to you, and you're able to have that information delivered to you. Such a
powerful. Right. A lot of people use Google Alerts, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that Google Alerts can be delivered as RSS feeds? So instead of having to plow through a half dozen different email messages, you can have everything aggregated into one simple Google Reader stream that will give you a very quick view of what's being said about you, your product, your companies in through Google Alerts.
Wonderful, wonderful point. So keep your...
I love RSS.
I love RSS. That's right. What's going on in your industry, what your competitors are doing, what people are saying about you. So number 2 is identifying opportunities.
Identifying opportunities is looking for expressed needs. And this can range from as simple as, it's amazing, when you go to LinkedIn, for example, or even on Twitter, and you search on terms like, can anyone recommend, or does anyone have any experience with, or looking for a good printer, or looking for a good physician, it's amazing how many queries people post with questions like that. One of my favorite examples of this was an auto repair shop in upstate New York who monitored Twitter geographically, because there is an option to monitor Twitter feeds geographically, and he looked for tweets that mentioned accidents or collisions. And after checking to be sure that everyone was okay, he would send these people a link to a list of questions that you should ask an automotive repair shop. And, of course, those questions were all questions that he could answer yes to. So this was a way for him to reach people at a time that they had a need and a rather urgent need, and to give them information that would actually enhance his business. So simply looking for people asking for questions about how can I get something done, what products do you recommend, simply searching on terms like that will often identify great opportunities.
Great. So opening up those doors and making it easy for people to ask questions that are also easy for you to answer and guide them to what you have to offer.
Absolutely. Last night, in fact, I was looking into alternatives for health insurance, and so I posted on Facebook, who's got some advice on how I can find a good health insurance plan. I got about 20 responses from my friends, and some very good ones, and those kinds of interactions go on all the time. Now, Facebook is more of a private forum, but LinkedIn, for example, is much more public. Blogs are more public. Twitter is public. So you can often find these discussions happening just by searching for them.
And you, speaking of which, you say, number three, build thought leadership through blogging. This is a stumbling block for a lot of people, largely, Paul, they say, because of the time factor. Tell us why it's so valuable.
Well, the time factor certainly is an issue, and one of the reasons Twitter is popular, of course, is that Twitter does not require a lot of time. There is a myth, I think, that people have to construct these very long, detailed, you know, 1,000-word blog entries, which really isn't the case. If you look at successful bloggers, you find that many of them, their blog entries are no more than 100 or 150 words, or even less than that. I think that building thought leadership can take simply the form of pointing people to other information on the Internet that you find useful that helps them to become more educated. So if you're going to have a blog, and I recommend that every B2B company should have a blog. I mean, really, I can't think of why you wouldn't want one. The more important thing is to post frequently, a couple of times a week. You don't have to have a great insight every time you post. You may simply want to point to a couple of recent articles that you've written or that you've read and say, this is what I found useful about this article. This is what I think you, the reader, might be able to take out of it. And that in itself is a form of thought leadership. It was wonderful. I discovered one lawyer in Florida who had done this as a way of becoming an expert at accident and personal injury law, and he had set up his blog as essentially a news feed of articles that he had pulled from around the web, probably using an RSS reader, about interesting cases involving auto accidents and personal injury claims. And he had done this to establish himself as an authority on this topic, in fact doing very little original research on his part, but mainly simply being in touch with what others were writing and what others were saying about that topic.
Well, let me ask you, Paul. How does that really establish thought leadership when you're aggregating content from other thought leaders, or does that just keep you in the game? Is there a difference?
Well, great thought leaders have great sources. If you look at any great academic book, what you'll find is that it's stuffed with footnotes, and that's because thought leaders read and consult the advice of others in order to form their own opinions. So there's certainly nothing wrong with pointing to the insights of others that you respect. Now, if that's all you do, then that probably has limited utility. So I recommend that that every so often you take maybe an article that you refer to that you respected, and you comment on it, you add to it, you provide some perspective, you explain how this information may be useful to the reader that you're trying to reach. But there's certainly nothing wrong with citing other useful information and occasionally commenting upon it.
Good point. And I love that we're telling small business owners that you can do both. You can have original posts. You can do a video of you doing something. You can aggregate some content. There's three posts right there in 1 week period of time when you can really map that out and fit it into your schedule. Now, number four.
And I would recommend you look up some prominent bloggers. You know, Chris Brogan is a very good blogger in this area. Steve Rubell, some people who are on the what you call the Technorati A list are people who I think do this very well. And a lot of what they do is simply point to other people's content and incrementally add some commentary on top of it. But they're not writing long, long entries.
Very good. Good points. And we can do that in any industry. So good examples that you cited as well. Okay, number four, market research.
Market research is it used to be expensive. It used to be prohibitive for small businesses. It's now basically free. In fact, Google Documents has a tool called Google Forms that will enable you to put together a fairly useful survey tool for free. It takes a matter of a few minutes, and you can put together a survey. Or you can contract with a service like SurveyMonkey, which is a nominal monthly fee. There are even survey services that are free that you can put out there and then invite people to give you some feedback. Now, is this scientific? No. There's lots of bad research out on the Internet, and I would certainly never look at data that you gathered through a tool like that as being scientifically significant, but it's interesting, and interesting is good. So why not use it?
You can
simply tap into other conversations that people are having, and by listening to them, learn what's important to them without ever actually asking the question. So, you know, I can't imagine why anyone would pay $10,000 for focus groups anymore when you can essentially get focus groups for free now simply by tapping into to ongoing conversations.
That's such a powerful thing we're talking about here. Number five, support customers.
Supporting customers is a matter of making yourself making social media an alternative channel for customers to reach you, and you know many people are frustrated with the dialing the 800 number, with going through all the menu systems. You know, over the last 20 years, companies have done everything possible to make customer support as frustrating and just as annoying an experience as possible.
You can hardly form the words.
Exactly. I mean, I just had a customer experience this morning, so I'm at a particularly high level.
So did I. Judging
about this, but we have made customers experience such a bad experience for most people that we don't even want to call the number because we're sold to, and then we're transferred to somebody who doesn't speak English as a first language and can't answer our question, and all of this has been done in the name of cost cutting. It turns out, ironically, that customer service, which is the area that has experienced probably more cost cutting over the last 20 years than any area of corporate operations, has now become our weakest link. It's become our weakest exposure to the customer. And we can help to improve that now by using social channels such as Twitter and blogs and Facebook pages as a way for people to ask questions and get questions answered. But the important point I want to emphasize there, Donna Maria, is we have to answer the questions.
Yeah.
If you put out the opportunity for people to ask you a question and you don't respond to it, that's worse than not offering them the opportunity at all.
So we have
to make a commitment.
I'm so glad you said that. Very good point. If you're going to be there, you have to actually be there. And you've talked about soliciting feedback and, of course, dealing with customer service issues, which can be crisis management if you don't deal with it. So we've covered those points. This is really great. I want to let everyone know that if you want to know some of the best stories, really good, true-life stories about how companies are following Paul's and Eric's tips every day in their businesses, you need to get Social Marketing to the Business Customer by Paul Gillen and Eric Schwartzman. I know Eric wasn't able to make it today. We miss you, Eric. But, Paul, tell us where to go to get more information about you and how to find you in the last minute of our show.
Okay, well, that's very nice of you to say. If you look for B2B social media book on Google, you will find our Facebook page. We did choose to make Facebook our home page for the book. You can also find it, of course, on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other booksellers. Personally, my website is gillin.com. That's gillin.com. And my Twitter account is pgillin, P-G-I-L-L-I-N, and I'm on both all the time, and I welcome any and all discussions. I appreciate your giving me the opportunity.
Thank you. And Paul will answer you on Twitter and Facebook when you contact him. Thank you for joining us. We've got to wrap it up today. Thank you, listeners, for being here. Paul and Eric, fabulous book. I'll see you next week right on Indie Business Podcast. In the meantime, enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way.